Actu SF, les podcasts.
Bien, bonjour. Alors, excusez-nous pour le retard. Nous ferons tout de même une séance à peu près de un tout petit peu moins d'une heure, jusqu'à 16h, peut-être un tout petit peu moins pour être sûr que la transmission puisse se faire d'une table ronde à une autre. Je vous demande par avance d'excuser mon anglais, mais je vais, pour la simplicité de la conversation, m'exprimer à partir de maintenant en anglais. Je vais surtout laisser nos invités s'exprimer librement. Pour les personnes qui n'auraient pas encore de casque, vous pouvez lever la main et ou vous déplacer si vous en avez besoin. En tout cas, il y a des moyens de traduire. Maybe I can do it on both your accounts, that our guests would like to thank especially Loman, who was going to interpret, to translate during the session, in effect we would like to be we are very thankful to for the help of any and all interpreters, translators during those sessions. So I would like to begin. I will try to begin with telling you all I can about our guests, whom you already had the pleasure to meet during these sessions. I'm guessing Kim Stanley Robinson was an author of a lot of books. I won't present all them, and I wouldn't be able to do that in English, actually. And they are all, most of them are showing on the just above us. He will be able, from this perspective and from all his experience in scientific discourse and science fiction writing, will be able to tell a lot of things about the legacy from the future or legacy of the future that we'll be discussing today. Also with us is Claire North, who goes by other names, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say them out loud here. Yes, I could. Catherine Webb, for example. But Claire North is the science fiction persona she's using, and the one who's being invited here to discuss this topic with us, we'll have the chance to talk about some of the books during the talk if that comes around. But je vous recommande bien sûr les 15 premières vies d'Harry Auguste, who are specifically talking about the idea of dealing with messages from the future. It goes into the subject. So, what are we talking about today? We're talking about something we have chosen to call the legacy of the future, the idea is that in the future, people will be looking back to what we are doing right now, and especially at our time, we are to ask ourselves whether it would be, they would be pleased with that, and what they would expect us to do. So it's like a Kantian paradox. Ask yourself what your future self, what your progeny, what your children would ask you to do right now regarding the various crises we are dealing with. But the word, I would like to begin with something about the words themselves. We have chosen the word legacy, which deals with the idea of something being transmitted. But we could have used also the idea of inheritance, the idea of our children are to inherit the earth. But if we talk about inheritance, we are dealing with a capitalistic way of looking at the transmission, the way there's some kind of capital, something that's is to be preserved, but to be preserved to be because we possess it, because we have it. And there's another way of looking at the same idea with the word heritage. And the word heritage, which would be translated in patrimoine, which is a problem in French, heritage, means that we have a responsibility to look after what is not exactly ours, but what is in our care. So I would like to begin, if you are okay with that, with this idea of those two ways of looking at a legacy as something that is ours and that we need to preserve because it's ours, or the idea of a legacy that is to be preserved because we have a responsibility, a moral responsibility toward it. I don't know if that's something you can play with to maybe Claire?
That's not a small topic on which to begin. So let's begin with neuroscience, because we've started big. The only thing that really elevates human beings above dolphins, and it is questionable how much we are elevated above dolphins right now, is our ability to transmit ideas from generation to generation. These ideas are as simple as counting from 1 to 10, and they're as complicated as constructed ideas as, say, gender or your emotions. Different cultures experience emotions in different ways. The idea of anger is transmitted differently. The idea of grief is transmitted differently from generation to generation. Every act we do is, by our very nature as humans, transmitting a cultural idea from the past to the future. A lot of our cultural ideas right now are awful, although being here, it is nice at least to look at a science fiction community and a convention like this and say that the stories can and are being changed. So I think when we talk about inheritance, yes, there is the capitalist idea of property, and there is indeed an almost Gaian idea of the world as an inheritance, which arguably can be linked to capital. Let's not even, well, maybe we should go there. But I think it's also really important to just begin with the fact that humans, of their nature, transmit.
Oh. Kim?
Yeah, thank you for that, Claire and Simon. I think that science fiction is a historical literature. It is meant to be a story set in the future that either explicitly or implicitly tells the story of how that world came out of our world. So it's inherently historical, and every science fiction novel expresses a theory of history going forward. And so there is this matter of the transfer down the generations of something. I don't like legacy or patrimony because it seems to be speaking about property or about something that isn't us. And I guess I would suggest that it'd be useful to think of humanity as a kind of a group creature that we as individuals are just cells in a larger body that survives onward for thousands of years. So it's a matter of do you live on in a healthy way, or do you do self-destructive things such that the body that is humanity is damaged going forward? So not an object, but really internalized as part of our bodies. Do we live a healthy civilization or an unhealthy civilization? But and then to this question of science fiction, which is what we do, you have this story in the future, and it's telling one way or another how that future came to be from our present. It's a judgment. You come back out of the world of the novel, back into this world, and you look at this world differently. You look at it as if it's the past of some future world, which I take it is really the point of this discussion. If you were to look at what we're doing now from the point of view of a future civilization, some, let's say 500 years from now, they look back. By analogy, when we look back 500 years, we see massive amounts of injustice and stupidity. We tend to judge them. Oh my gosh, they were so unenlightened. They were so cruel. They were so foolish. They were so stupid. But when you play the science fiction game, all of those feelings get reflected back on us now. 500 years from now, they're going to look back at the year 2023, the early 21st century, going to be amazed and perhaps horrified. How could people have been so wasteful? How could they have been so stupid? And then you walk outdoors, out of the science fiction novel, back into our present moment, and it gives you a new way of seeing your own reality that is more historical, more transtemporal, more a way of looking back. And one thing I hope it does is that it might make you less judgmental about the people of the past. This presentism in history right now, oh, they were so horrible in the 19th century. Well, in the 19th century, they were just like us, and some of them were horrible, some of them weren't. They were all working within a structure of feeling, like Claire was describing. Even our emotions are culturally based and linguistically based, and they're in a structure. They were doing their best in their structure. We're in our structure. We ought not to be so judgmental of the past. We should really be judging ourselves from the aspect of the future.
I think it's also important to say that science fiction obviously does reflect the times in which we live now in very obvious and fundamental ways. I think of a lot of the science fiction of, say, 1960s, 1970s, the golden age of science fiction gave us some breathtaking ideas, and women were completely absent because women were simply invisible from a lot of fiction at that time. I think the science fiction now, and we have a lot of climate fiction, which is fantastic, and obviously you're a current leader on that, and that reflects the anxieties of the time. I think if you also expand that to the idea of humanity as a cellular organism going forward, there's always been, I think, quite an interesting give and take in science fiction between narratives of almost a collective identity. And I think of, for example, the works of Ursula Le Guin, who explores the difference between the collective and the individual and how that transmits culturally. Or indeed something like Star Trek, which fundamentally, at its best, has been a collective narrative of people working together versus a lot of science fiction's hero narratives. Right now, we're in the age of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where it is all about the heroes who will save us. And I think a lot of these narratives are very relevant going forward in terms of, will the future look back and say we were saved by heroes? Very unlikely. Or are we going to be saved by collective action? And I think that question to this day remains fundamental to a lot of our social problems and is reflected in our literature.
Yeah, and I want to register a deep disbelief in the whole narrative line that is represented by Marvel. And the shift from science fiction to fantasy is a shift into magical thinking, where no longer do we actually make history, but it happens to us. And since there is no magic, every time you indulge in a story that depends on magic or superpowers for its resolution, you have a problem pointed out by H.G. Wells long ago, where anything is possible, nothing is interesting. And so those movies are not interesting because anything's possible. And at a certain point, the writer will say, okay, now the good guy has to win. Suddenly their superpower is finally strong enough to defeat the bad guys. And since you knew that was going to happen all along, the whole thing is a waste of narrative time. I want to pick up on something else that Claire said. There were women writing science fiction all along. Sometimes they had to use men's names. But there we're talking about the 1930s, the 1940s. In the 1950s, we began to see more and more women under their own names. And in the 1960s, there was a proliferation. One tends to remember the charismatic megafauna. One tends to do a thing of tokenism. So there's one woman science fiction writer, Ursula Le Guin, or you can even mention the big three, Le Guin, James Tiptree Jr., and Joanna Russ. But the thing is, there was also Elizabeth Vonnegut, and there was Eleanor Arneson, and there are still, there was Suzette Hayden Elgin, and Susie McCarnes. There was feminist science fiction that was intensely alive in the 1970s. And then, I want to say this because it's an old complaint, the cyberpunk guys wanted to go back to the parking lot and drink and smoke cigarettes and wear black jackets and pretend that they were punks. And they took us back to the 50s and they erased the feminist science fiction of the 70s. They said to the world, nothing interesting happened in the 1970s. It erased feminist science fiction that was quite intense and powerful. And suddenly it was cyberpunk and it was back to guys sneaking around in the dark streets doing their cool cyberpunk thing. No, it was an erasure. It was bad. It took science fiction backwards a generation or so into an earlier and simpler and less interesting time. So as an anti-cyberpunk from back in those wars, I just want to point out, feminist science fiction was one of the victims of cyberpunk supremacy of the 1980s. It was a Reaganist, Thatcherist counter-revolution against progressive science fiction.
In a way, that I think most of what you said shows that there's some kind of point of view from which to project a future. And if there are people missing, women, for example, that if there's no woman point of view, the way of looking at the future becomes more masculine, for example. Regarding that, what would you say that right now in the science fiction scene are the cues from what are the things that are used to project into the future? In a way, I would rephrase and say, do you think that science fiction is right now a real power of interpretation of the present? Maybe it's a bit too much to ask, but my question is, I will rephrase it from a different perspective and to give it more context. The question is that right now, the idea is floating around in literature history and maybe philosophy, I don't know, that our present time is shaped more by presentism, by the focus on the present, more than on futurism, that futurism is some kind of thing of the past, that it was linked to ideologies of the 20th century. And that in that way, what can be the role of science fiction? Can science fiction be a potent tool right now to shape the future? Obviously, you're doing it, and that's why you're doing. But do you think it's we can expect it to have an impact?
I am going to break my answer into three parts. Part one, I think futurism is currently being suborned by capitalism, to be perfectly honest. I think when I think of futurism, I think of Silicon Valley bros who are telling us a number of pernicious lies, such as death is going to be overcome, cars are going to drive themselves, and we're going to invent carbon capture technology tomorrow that means we can all keep our fossil fuels. I think a lot of the narrative about what our future looks like is being suborned and taken over by a very pernicious, frankly, neo-capitalist elite. And we can fight that, and science fiction is a good part of fighting that. I think that science fiction still struggles to a certain extent with literary snobbiness. I think it is still quite difficult to get the mainstream literary market to look at science fiction and go, wow, this is actually incredibly important and relative to our destination as humanity. And so while science fiction, I think, does have a huge role to play in talking about the future, that role could be made bigger if we all just got over ourselves sooner rather than later. And it is hugely encouraging that stuff like Ministry Like the Future is getting that attention and that respect. But it is also unusual, and that is a real tragedy. The final thing I'd say is that I think science fiction, and actually also fantasy, shout out to every fantasy bro who's like, oh, but I do like a wizard. I like a wizard too. I think it is really important to say that science fiction and fantasy is also working in more subtle ways that I think will communicate cultural change. For example, I think as well as a lot of climate fiction lately, there has been a lot of fiction that is questioning gender norms. It's going, what is male? What is female? What are the relationships we've taken for granted? What are the structures we've taken for granted? And in a quiet background way is changing how we think about these very fundamental ideas. And that doesn't need to be spectacular. That doesn't need to be a huge, big science fiction idea. If that just becomes a normalized part of how we write and how we think and how we transmit ideas.
I would agree with that and just add that we are living in a science fiction novel that we are all writing together. What I mean by that is that history has accelerated, technologies have grown powerful, there are more people on the planet than ever before. We're in a climate crisis, we're in all kinds of unprecedented new situations. Science fiction as a historical literature that's trying to say that the future is going to be different from now and that you can try to work towards a good future rather than a bad one, well, that's been happening since World War II at an increasing acceleration to the point where we're now in the science fiction scenarios that have been described for this past generation. So whatever the mainstream was is a kind of a residual island of mid-20th century normality, and they might want to pretend to still be in that, but we aren't still in that. We're in a science fiction novel. So it's become kind of the realism of our time, and it does a pretty good job of capturing the feel. And the feeling is really what literature is about, a way of relating to the present that's cognitive but also emotional. So really, I think science fiction has become a coping mechanism and also a mapping device. It maps the present in ways that are useful in finding your way.
Yeah, I think I'd also add to that the emotional aspect is incredibly important. As a climate activist, the thing you constantly run up against is people going, I am terrified of climate change. I'm terrified of what's coming. And fear is a paralytic. And fear is the narrative that has been used by fossil fuel companies to go, don't do anything. You're going to be eating ashes and sackcloth, so you might as well continue driving your gas guzzler. It's not going to make a difference. We're all going to burn. Keep buying my product. Fear keeps us down, whereas what I think science fiction can do, indeed what all literature can do, including fantasy, including any book that gives you a sense of hope, is it can turn around and go, no, the mission is to create something you want, not to live in this oppressive terror of now, but to actually imagine a better future and create it through hope. Narratives that create change are always hopeful rather than oppressive and terrifying. Some people are triggered by dystopias. Some people read 1984 and go, wow, I'm going to go and join the Green Party. But most people actually want something to hope for. And in that sense, I think all of fiction has something to offer on an emotional level in a way that just facts and stats don't.
Yeah, and I want to force myself to be sure to say something positive about fantasy and what it does. And because I'm so much on the side of science fiction, and there's so much about fantasy that I dislike as being not a realism, as being an escape. But here's the thing. Fantasy reminds us that reality is constructed, and very often the fantasy is about being an animal and relating to other animals. And so there's, and even the fantasies like Lord of the Rings, where different species are cooperating with each other, is clearly a metaphor for different cultures, different language groups.
The mic is not working.
Yeah, I heard that drop off.
Is this still working? Oh, mine's still working. I have mine. We'll make it work.
All right. These are always metaphors for difference, and besides which, since we are animals, to be reminded that I'm an animal, I'm a mammal, I'm very well acquainted with lions and tigers and bears and other creatures, and in fact I feel like one myself. That's right, and that's a perception that in modern society can be lost. So there's a lot of fantasy that is holding on to indeed a legacy of what was obvious to us in our deep past and is easy to lose now, and so fantasy brings it back, and that's the joy of it. Not just identifying villains by their black hats and cutting their heads off with a sword, which is so nice, but also remembering that you're an animal amongst other animals and that you can talk to them and get along with them.
But we all hate cyberpunk.
Well, I do.
Well, just to clarify, and I don't want you to say bad things about some works, but would you say that there are there's some kind of problem in the ratio between some kind of climate fiction that could be more like disaster porn, the enjoyment of the catastrophe, and the ratio of more optimistic or constructive fiction? Just to to expand on what you've been saying about the idea of hope from one side and despair on the other, would you say that there's nothing constructive to be gained from disasters without end, like a novel like The Road, for example, and the whole thing that has been around that. Not to say bad things, but just to say that it's not the road to a better future.
Most disaster movies are very rarely about the disaster. They're about the fact that the puppy and the winsome child were saved. Usually they are just a gateway drug for people to go, oh, it's that guy from The Mandalorian. Isn't he hunky and paternal, and won't he give me a great big hug? Usually it's about a human experience rather than actually about the disaster. I say that, people watch the Saw movies and enjoy them. It is baffling to me. But majority of the time, it's about the puppy. These things are rarely about the big idea. They are about humans having feelings. I think the only problem about that is that it leads people to go, there's a disaster coming, I'm going to be a prepper, rather than people going, there's a disaster coming, I'm going to go and canvass for my local party. That's going to solve it. That does not make for a sexy narrative. And arguably, that is the only flaw with the wonder that is fiction. We are here to sell you sexy narratives, and going out and canvassing for your local Green Party and delivering leaflets is very hard to turn into something that catches people emotionally. So we do have a bit of a problem in that sense. Narratively, we like to tell big stories where things go boom, and that doesn't necessarily always transmit the richness of the ideas.
Yes, it's a terrible narrative problem to try to talk about daily life, to try to talk about work, but it's always existed, and so fiction on the page is there for characters with a plot, and two things happen in fiction that I think are very important that you can describe by way of science fiction tropes. You get telepathy. You are inside other people's minds, and that's very rare for us. And so when you read a novel and you're inside another character's thinking, this may be fictional, but it's also a real experience that's rare in real life. So we read for telepathy, and then we read for time travel. You get to go to other times and other places. So you're a Roman monk who's also a detective in the year 400, you know, in Rome, or you are on the moons of Jupiter in the year 3000. You have time travel, you have telepathy. This is what fiction can give you. And then dystopia, I think it's a kind of a comfort food. Oh my God, all this stuff is so terrible. It's instantly dramatic. There's a coping. Can you stay alive in these horrible situations? Can you bond with other people? Can you trust anyone, etc.? But at the end of the day, you come out of it, and what you can think then is, ah, at least my situation isn't as bad as those poor people who are fighting off zombies. So dystopia is a kind of a comfort food for where we are now, and even though our situation might be precarious, it's not as bad as those poor people. So I don't like dystopia. I mean, it has its use. It's obviously the warning, don't go this way, and that's a kind of a historical warning that I think is powerful. Or it can be the satire, like we're living lives as if we're rats in a cage. It has some satirical potential. But by and large, I think it's time has passed, that we already know the danger, and so reading dystopias is a way of not thinking about solutions.
I would just like to slightly carry that. I agree with the slight caveat that I think a lot of dystopian fiction is young adult fiction. And if we are talking about the legacy of the future, then celebrating and honoring and being grateful for young adult fiction should be right at the top of our to-do list. Dystopia is not necessarily teaching young adults to go out and do leafleting for their local party. Guys, join your local political party if you want change. Thank you. It's not necessarily teaching you to do that, but it is, I think, potentially encouraging young people to think of themselves as actors, as having agency. And so in that sense, I think it is interesting how much dystopia correlates with young adult fiction.
Well, yeah, and actually it's maybe one instance of what's really happening between a generation clash, because the main narratives of this kind of dystopias is young people coming to terms with the fact that the older generation has dealt them a bad hand, and they are trying to change it, while the older generation is just trying to keep things like as they are. So, in a way, well, if you look at it that way, it's a way to well, it may be a way to push toward change. Well. And if you want to react to that, you can. But if not, I would like to ask you then, what would be the path for a more responsible way of looking at the future? Well, a template. Obviously, it's what you've been doing. But if you could just lay it out and say what's happening at the time, because. And I'm linking it to another idea, but you can toss it away if you don't like it. It's the question that have been coming to my mind hearing you is that most people in mainstream literature are somehow writing for the posterity, for the happy few, or for the people who will get them in the future. But I would say that people in science fiction, well, writers in science fiction, are mostly writing for the present people, to talk about what's the deal right now and what we are to do with what we are given right now. And in a way, it's a call for action when it's done properly. Well, I don't know if that checks out. If it's a bit complicated.
Well, if you put a story in the future and then you have, you're comparing what's in the story to the present, it provides you a cognitive map, and this is very basic to science fiction thinking, extrapolation. If this goes on, we'll get to this point, and then you come back to the present. Very often I find, and this is true in young adult fiction a lot, it's about making family that's more than the biological family, of trusting other people and making teams that work together for social goals. So it's very often about sociability and regarding a world that is maybe dystopian, within that dystopia, a bubble of family and trust. Can you create it? Can you hold on to it? Might it be revolutionary? And I think one of the, maybe it's an example that most people will be familiar with, the Hunger Games. That society does not make sense in logistical grounds, but as a symbolic portrait for young people of the way the world feels. There are rich people who are not only taking advantage of us, but are pitting us against each other for their own entertainment, their own decadent and even sick entertainment. And we are victims that don't have control of our own lives. Could we try a revolution? Or could we at least know that we have some friends? So this, on the symbolic level, there are stories that make no sense historically or logistically. It couldn't happen that way. Where is the food grown? Who's making those bows and arrows? None of that matters. It's the feeling of it, the symbolic portrait that's being made. So there's use value in running these stories through your head and reading them and experiencing them with telepathy, with time travel. Oh my God, I was in terrible trouble, and now through the trust of my friends, I got out of it. That feeling comes back into the world, and you try to inject it into your daily life, but also your social life, which means your political life. So there is use value.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a common trope that writers are terrible, terrible people, and it's because they usually are. They're usually terrible people because they don't get out enough, they're not paid enough, they have no real metrics for self-worth, and so they get their self-worth by going, hey, tell me how awesome you think I am. The point of this is that when writers write and tell stories, they are fundamentally doing something human and empathetic. They are trying to create a journey in which you get into someone else's head. They are trying to create a shared human experience. They are also just fools in their pajamas eating biscuits by a keyboard. Both these things are simultaneously true. You as readers, when you read, are experiencing something incredibly fundamental and humane. You are empathizing and experiencing someone else's point of view. The book doesn't even have to be about big ideas. The book can be cyberpunk. And so long as you are having an emotional experience and experiencing something empathetic and having a human reaction, you are already becoming part of a bigger collective of humanity. You are part of a large cellular organism rather than alone. How does this relate to the legacy of the future? One of the things that I think is holding us back as a species is the sense that we are too small to do anything. What is the point of my individual action, given the scale of everything, given the scale of global problems, given the terror of global problems? And so I think it is our job as writers to say, you matter. When you read, when you write, you are connecting with something big and humane. When you are here, you are communicating with like-minded people about something big and humane. Guys, we are nerds. Be a nerd and celebrate the things that matter to you. Go out from this festival and tell people, I read science fiction about the climate crisis. I have thoughts about the climate crisis. I have thoughts about the future. The way your actions make a difference and the way our actions make a difference is by communicating the things that matter to us. We are tiny and insignificant, but the fact there are so many of us here proves the power of our culture to change. And you can make that happen by going forth and communicating and also incidentally buying the books of great writers who you love. But that's secondary. Go forth and speak of what matters, and that is how we change everything, and that's what the point of books should really be.
As long as we are bashing cyberpunk...
Cyberpunk's great.
No, I agree. The idea is... My question was just simply, do you think there's a real solarpunk movement? There's something that's... the opposite. It would be the opposite of cyberpunk. Do you think it's a thing? Do you think it relates to some kind of movement? And would you say that actually there's a trend of positive thinking science fiction right now?
I hope that there is, and there's definitely a thing called solar punk. I want to register my own personal objection to the suffix punk. Cyberpunk, okay. This is Gardner Dozois. He's making up a name. He's trying to describe a structure of feeling, a type of science fiction, capitalist realism. We're never going to overthrow the system. The revolution has failed. Find your fate on the mean streets, and it's film noir over again. Fine. It happened. I didn't like it. But then steampunk. Suddenly the suffix is stuck on other things. Victorian fiction with high technology, that doesn't need the suffix punk, but it got it, and the trend had begun. So cyberpunk, steampunk, now we have solar punk and hope punk. Well, punk is about rejecting everything and going out and getting drunk every night and trying to tear down the system, and it's a giving upness. So punk was always a failure mode. So it's a bad suffix, but hope punk is a paradox in terms and makes no sense conceptually, it's the name for a bunch of young writers who are doing a bricolage of small-scale efforts to accommodate the planet and get along better with the biosphere, make use of what you have, and maybe that's what it's referring to make a better world. It is, in short, utopian fiction. But you can't go into publishers' offices and say, I want to write utopian fiction. It doesn't sell. It's not smart. It is always been a niche, a marginal niche pursued by crazy people, and I can count the utopian writers in the history of the world on my fingers and my toes. And in my own lifetime, there's Ursula Le Guin, there's Ian M. Banks, there's me, there's Cory Doctorow, There is indeed a few utopian writers around, but it's a marginal way to get yourself published. So it's better to be hope punk. It's better to be solar punk, to be a movement. And exactly like cyberpunk, if there's 10 of you together, even though, and you happen to have one star, then you can make a movement and maybe you can sell some books. I'm very, I don't like literary schools. I think they are always instrumental and they're always bad for the writers who join them. But if you have to do it to get published, you might as well be hope punk, you might as well be solar punk. As their grandfather, I say to them, even in the Solar Punk magazine, issue number one, introduction by Kim Stanley Robinson, please, people, call yourself utopian fictions. Fine, Stan, he's old, he's a hippie, we are solar punk, and don't worry about him. It's fine. They're still writing the right kind of stories, and that's really what matters. I've objected to climate fiction, I've objected to names of all kinds. It doesn't matter. That's not really the point. It's the stories, the people, the reading that you do, the reactions that you have afterwards. So I register this just as a point of interest and maybe as a political point that one ought to be able to say this is political fiction, this is utopian fiction, without getting in trouble for it.
Thank you.
The two words that are going around my head as you speak were Star Trek, which was conceived, you could argue, as utopian space opera, and has done very well. Although, notably, in recent years, the makers of Star Trek have gone, you know what we need to infuse a bit of drama into this? Some dystopian, messed up stuff. And that's a real shame, because it's got bad. Sorry, Trekkers. But I think the point is there is a way of telling utopian stories. Star Trek did it. And what is interesting, I think, about Star Trek at its best is that utopia was everyone's just getting along with each other competently. Don't you just love it when people turn up and are competent in a story? This has been a real problem with a lot of late Star Trek. People have been idiots. But if that's all it takes for utopia, I'm there for it. I am there for our utopia, is people just get together and are competent. And that's fine, because what's out there is so vast and fascinating and interesting and exciting that Star Trek didn't need to have everyone sleeping with everyone else in a really messed up way to create drama. It had the wonder of the universe and the vast expanse possibility of life to make utopian narrative. I don't really have any further point than that, other than just like, Star Trek, yo.
And in a way, the circle is complete, because Star Trek is one of the shows and worlds where the idea of going back to the present time and look at the way people are messing it up at the present is a recurring theme. But the idea is also that it's out of this mess that utopia could evolve. And that's in a way that they are trying to have it both ways, to say that that there really is a problem and they are facing it, but also saying that if we do it properly, well, we can ascend to another kind of civilization. And I would say it's a message of hope that resonates with most of what we have said today.
That was very neat, and I'm going to butt in with a completely not literary point. If you feel right now that the world is a rubber band on the verge of snapping, if you feel that the economy is going to snap and the climate is going to snap and that we've just had a pandemic and it's still here, guys, if you feel that everything's going to snap and you are hoping for the revolution to come and fix everything, then in the name of all that's holy, be part of that revolution. Because if you're not, Lenin will take control, and we all know how that worked out.
No thoughts on Lenin.
It should be bottom up. There's every town, every village, there's an organization doing good work. Work for children, work for animals, work for the environment. You don't have to go home and make it up from scratch. You can join it. It makes you more than just a voter. It makes you a citizen that's actually doing something. It can be very small, and yet it means you have more of an impact. It's tangible. And that kind of work, I was at COP26 in Glasgow a couple of years ago, and it was all very top level international diplomats discussing things at the level of the planet as a whole. That's necessary and important. And I went home to Davis, California, and there's a little organization I didn't even know about called Cool Davis. Well, it's just a group of people getting together to try to do more to get off fossil fuels fast, to green the environment. And what I've realized now, talking to people traveling around, that kind of organization exists in every town on this planet, really, except for places that are in social breakdown. But let's say in the developed world or in places where people have a society that they can trust for the necessities, then those kind of progressive organizations exist. So it's something that you can do. And I think science fiction is very often about that kind of work towards the future. Ministry for the Future has had a big response, but that's because there were already literally thousands of ministries for the future. And so there's a feeling of recognition there that this story is not just in the future and global, but is now and taking place in my village.
Thank you. If you'd like, we can open questions to the floor for about 10 minutes, because you have to be somewhere else after that. So 10 minutes of questions, 10 minutes de questions. And I don't know, maybe... if we can understand the questions in French.
We cannot. Nous ne parlons pas français. Je suis désolé. How do you want to do this?
On a besoin d'arrêter?
Thank you. Some questions.
Je sais pas si. Oh. Ah, le micro.
Ah.
En français ou en anglais les questions?
Anglais, s'il vous plaît.
In English, if you can manage, and if not, I will translate quickly.
Okay, I'll do my best. Claire, my question is for you. You were talking about Star Trek. On the recent series, just out of curiosity, have you seen the Strange New World series?
I have not seen Strange New Worlds because there are more subscription services now under the sun than anyone can ever subscribe to. However, all the reviews have said it's doing the thing where people get along and are competent and experience a sense of wonder. So, thumbs up for that. Have you seen Strange New Worlds? There is a microphone wandering. Où est le microphone?
I don't know.
Où est le microphone? Où est... No. Oh, we're getting a big X sign that implies no microphone. For everyone who could not hear that, that was a lovely statement expressing how wonderful it is to see Kim Stanley Robinson in France and how amazing Kim Stanley Robinson is.
I agree.
Merci.
Ease this process. What I might do is run into the audience and get questions.
Thank you very much.
Well. Well, this is a hands-on conference. C'est vraiment pratique. Oui, mais donc là, en fait, on va colporter, récupérer la question en fait, et on va vous dire. De toute façon, on va bientôt arrêter. Hein, je suis désolé, c'est un peu improvisé, mais j'espère que vous avez apprécié la conférence jusqu'ici, et puis on va bientôt laisser les choses se faire.
Question number one. There is not much science fiction, I'm paraphrasing, apologies, but get it complete. There's not much science fiction that addresses geoengineering. I know you've talked about it a bit. I'm in the wrong chair. Never mind. There's a lot about geoengineering in a dystopian way, but not necessarily in a positive way. How do you address geoengineering?
Well, thank you for that. It's a good question. Yes, thank you. Geoengineering. That word is a name for bad things that we do to the world to try to make up for previous bad things that we did, and therefore, by definition, geoengineering is bad. Before you've thought about it. Well, this is an attitude from maybe 1990. There hasn't been very much science fiction about it that's very up to date in terms of the present methods. And I want to say that there's all kinds of interventions in the Earth system that we could do that might help to reduce the global temperatures in ways that might allow us to adjust to our slow decarbonization, because we're going too slowly. And I think it's like this. Some of these methods are rather small scale. Could you slow down the glaciers? Could you brighten the lowest level marine clouds? Could you thicken the ice in the Arctic oceans? And then could you cast dust into the atmosphere like a volcano? So it's like talking about tools, an axe, a hammer, a saw, and an atomic bomb. Well, naturally, everybody's attention goes to the atomic bomb or the atomic weapon, which is to say solar radiation management, this casting of dust into the atmosphere. It's global. It can't be done by experiment first. It would have to be done. And it could have some negative side effects. And so it gets all the attention, even though there are other interventions that might be quite useful that are underneath the umbrella of the name geoengineering. And we are going to have to pull billions of tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We're in a carbon dioxide overshoot. Pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere should not be defined as a bad thing, because we did it in the first place. We did it very fast on geological terms. We need less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can do it by growing trees. You can do it by growing kelp beds. You can do it by regenerative agriculture, which has got French leadership, the 4 parts per thousand. For every year you have 4 parts per thousand more carbon in the soil while you grow your food. This too could be called geoengineering, but regenerative agriculture is a really good idea. So the term geoengineering ought to be perhaps dropped from the vocabulary so that each one of these methods gets evaluated on its own merits, its costs, its benefits, its positives, its negatives. And let's keep solar radiation management in a special category of its own as particularly global and particularly irrevocable. That one is hard, and governance issues are being discussed right now at levels from the town hall to the UN. It might help. There are people in this world that when you say to them, we could lower the temperature for 5 years, what do you say? They say, do it. We need it badly. We're dying here. So the discussion needs to be modernized. It needs to be brought up to date to reflect the emergency that we're in. And so that's my quick take on geoengineering, and I think it's important to not have any knee-jerk reactions to anything going. As we go forward, we're in an all-hands-on-deck situation. We're in an emergency. Things are going to have to happen that seemed quite bizarre 30 years ago.
Merci. On va arrêter ici. Thank you for your patience and for attending. And thanks to Claire North and Kim Stanley Robinson for a very lively session. And thanks again to Lohmann for translating for us. Thank you.
ActuSF. Les podcasts.